This is the takeaway for Friday, March 24th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. The day is finally here, at least for House Republicans. Their promise to repeal and replace Obamacare, it's fair to say, is on life support. You know, it's that moment when you hover over a collapsed patient and yell to whoever will listen, "Is there a doctor in the house?" You might be looking for the healing hands of Dr. Tom Price over at HHS or even Dr. Ben Carson. What House Republicans have is Dr. Donald Trump.
The fact is, you were given many lies. Go with our plan. It's going to be terrific. You're going to be very, very happy. Call your local representative. Call your senator. Let them know that you're behind our plan.
House Republicans are not so sure that this urgent cure is terrific, as the president says. All week long, the American Health Care Act has been struggling for GOP votes. And Americans don't seem to want to swallow this pill either. A new poll by Quinnipiac University put support for the American Health Care Act at just 17%. House Speaker Paul Ryan has been busy, though, negotiating with Republicans when he can and waiting for news on deals that some of his members are cutting with the president directly. So we want to look at this moment for Republicans now, elected promising to repeal Obamacare, electing a president promising that everyone will have great health care for less money, and staring down the barrel of an agenda that could suffer if they can't get this done. Reed Galen is a political consultant and Republican strategist. He worked on both the 2000 and 2004 Bush-Cheney campaigns. He also worked for John McCain's campaign. Welcome to The Takeaway, Reed.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Also with me here in studio, Jeffrey Young. He's a senior reporter and longtime healthcare watcher with the Huffington Post. Jeff, welcome.
Hello, Todd.
Great to have you. Reed, let me start with you. What do you see going on here in this Republican moment? A new president elected, two congressional majorities, repeal of Obamacare on the tip of their tongue for years. What's happening now from the eyes of a GOP strategist?
Well, I think what you're seeing is that health care, regardless of party, is always going to be very difficult. Next, I think that for Republicans, they are now a party divided in so many ways. They're sort of unmoored from their, you know, the past ideological bases that made up the traditional GOP. And so what you have is a Freedom Caucus who is pretty much anti-everything, who does not like this. They want a full repeal. And then you have Republican moderates who have to go home and deal with angry town hall meetings where, you know, the constituents want to know why 24 million people are going to lose their health care over the next decade. So I think what you're seeing is a Republican Party in turmoil and with a leader who was only a Republican in name only, truly, who has provided, you know, start and stop support for this and now has resorted to threats of individual members, which I don't think is helpful either.
Okay, Jeff Young, a Republican Party in turmoil now grabbing onto an issue that's never been easy for any party. But if you look at the history of healthcare and Republicans, it's always been especially difficult for them. They've never had an easy time with this issue, and now it's really a mess.
Yeah, I think it might be helpful to start out contrasting it with the other party, and that is, you know, it took over a year to get the Affordable Care Act passed in the first place. But what Democrats had that Republicans don't is kind of an overall sense, ideologically, philosophically, of what they were trying to achieve. You know, the Democratic Party, American liberals, think more people should have health coverage and that people who can't afford it should get help paying for it. You know, the mechanism to get there was obviously flexible. A lot of Democrats favored single payer, and they ended up with something where it's private insurance companies with some federal money and regulations around it. There has never, in my observation, been a kind of core defining conservative principle of what the healthcare system in America should be. You know, I mean, Republicans opposed Medicare and Medicaid when they came around, but now they defend Medicare, and a lot of them defend Medicaid as well, because they already exist. You know, and what we've seen, and you know, Todd, you and I covered Congress every day for a long time. because there's no core defining principle and because there are other priorities that are more important to Republican lawmakers and to conservative voters, this has never been an issue that they have pushed forcefully themselves. So now they're in a position where because they don't like the Affordable Care Act and have portrayed it as, frankly, much worse than it actually is, they can't do nothing, but they don't really know what they want to do instead.
And I think we're seeing that play out. In other words.
Right.
So, Reid Galen, that's an important issue, what they're for. It seems like Republicans now are looking at a bill. We've seen the CBO scores, 24 million estimated could lose coverage. Many of them, though, if we talk about the politics here, many of those people, working class whites, Trump voters, what kinds of calculations are going on in the heads of lawmakers right now as they look at this bill, what the impact might be and what it might mean for them back home?
I think that what we should remember is that I don't know if you ever remember the movie The Candidate with Robert Redford.
Sure.
When at the end of the movie he wins and he looks at his campaign manager Peter Boyle and he says, well, what do we do now? And I think the Republicans in Congress had that moment when Donald Trump actually won the presidency. Everyone assumed, me included, that Hillary Clinton was going to be president and it was going to be status quo, you know, on Obamacare and many other things. So, you know, they had 7 years of repeal votes, 50-some votes in the House or whatever it was. Suddenly they find themselves with both the White House and the Congress and no plan what to speak of. You know, I assume that, you know, President Obama worked for years or thought about this for years or had healthcare policy experts working on these things for years. The Republicans, I think, to your point, Jeff, did not have that, did not have anything laying on the shelf. And so now I think what we're in is a place where how do we get out of this, you know, with the least damage possible? If it's a win, we'll take any win we can get. If it's going to be a loss, we're not going to put it to a vote.
Okay, that's interesting what Reid says there, Jeff. But what is a win here? I cited at the top this new Q poll, Quinnipiac University poll. 17% of Americans say they back this effort. Only 40% of Republicans say they're for it. Republicans are now in a position where they have to repeal Obamacare because it's the only reason to be a Republican for the last 7 years. But it seems like success is not really success, at least if you ask voters.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of almost impossible position, although my sympathy is limited because this is something the party is – a position the party has put itself in. You know, I mean, I know this will never happen, but there is an alternative here that no one's talking about. You know, the president is saying, well, you either pass this bill – or we leave the Affordable Care Act in place as is. The third option is to fix what's not working about the Affordable Care Act and the American healthcare system in a way that makes it better for people. But this bill doesn't really attempt to do that in a very meaningful or broad way because it's being assembled and reassembled and disassembled just to get votes. Now, that's how legislation passes. But if you look at the machinations that have been going on the last few days, it's all about vote counting and not about how do we make insurance better for people? How do we make healthcare more affordable? It just doesn't really get at that.
So, Jeff, you talked a little bit about the history of Republicans with healthcare, that they've never articulated what they're for. They've managed to articulate over the last 7 years and years before that what they're against. They've had a couple little things about what they're for. Is there something particularly hard about this Republicanism right now after the elections of having Donald Trump lead a party full of Paul Ryan conservatives and then trying to bake a healthcare cake? Is there something harder about this moment?
Well, I mean, for starters, you know, during the campaign, the president said a lot of things during the campaign, but when it came down to healthcare, you know, he tried to make it simple. We're going to cover everybody. It's going to be better and cheaper. You're going to love it. Your deductibles under Obamacare are too high. Well, we're going to bring them down. This bill doesn't do any of those things, right? So first of all, you've got those promises hanging out there. And then second, you know, I mean, the divide in the House Republican Conference right now, I feel like there's three camps. There's the speaker and most of them who are just willing to vote for this bill because they want to get it out of the way or because they want to ding Obamacare or whatever. Then you've got the so-called moderates, people who I think, to put it simply, are worried about getting hit with flack from kicking 24 million people off their health insurance. And then there's the Freedom Caucus, the conservatives, right, who don't think this bill takes insurance away from enough people quickly enough. I don't know how you bridge all of that. It just sort of seems incompatible.
To get to 216.
Yeah.
And then Reid Galen, the inevitable consequence of this, even if and when this bill passes, is the Senate. then the Senate seems to have no interest in this bill as is. And it makes me want to ask you to step back a little bit. The rest of the Republican agenda, healthcare is the first thing, but it's not the only thing. What happens to Republicans' ability to pass other things that they want if this fails? Things like tax reform and more tax cuts, an infrastructure plan that the president wants. They have to fund the government, raise the debt limit. What happens to Republicans' ability to govern if they can't do this?
Well, I think it probably becomes a lot like what we saw with the end of President Obama's administration, which is, you know, things get done on an as needed, on a by crisis basis, rather than, you know, some regular legislative process that we might have expected with a president and a Congress of the same party. I think that, you know, if the idea is that, you know, this health care plan, which would have, you know, a disproportionate poor effect on lower income Americans, indigent Americans, those already without insurance, is unpopular, then the idea that Republican tax reform, which is likely to be a boon to corporations and frankly likely wealthy individuals as well, is not going to be that much more popular. So what I think you're going to see are absolute essential pieces of legislation move through, and then, you know, maybe bite-sized pieces of little things that both the Republican Congress and President Trump can take into 2018. Otherwise, they very well could get to November of next year without anything to show for it.
And Reid, how much harder? We talked about the unpopularity of this bill, 17%. If you're a member of Congress and you look at the president's numbers, around 37% approval right now, what does that say to you about whether or not you want to vote for this?
I think it says, you know, it's every member for themselves. You know, we should expect, as you all probably know, having covered the Hill, that in a president's first term, they are likely to lose seats. I think the question is, how many seats are they going to lose? I don't think they can lose the majority. But I think at this point, each member is taking stock of what they need to do for their constituents. If it means keeping that promise and voting something that takes out Obamacare, maybe they vote for it. If it means that, you know, you didn't go far enough with a full repeal, then you're not going to vote for it, because the Freedom Caucus, if anything, believes in their own purity. So I think that right now the caucus and the party generally, again, is of many minds. I think, as Jeff said, you know, Democrats have the advantage, especially on health care, of always having been of one mind. Republicans are of many minds, none of which agree with each other.
Jeff, we have just a few seconds left, but I do want to point out, and I think you should too, as fraught and as difficult as all of this is, this is step one. This goes to the Senate.
Yeah. And I it's hard to see a path through there right now.
And I mean, senators have shown no interest in this. This has to come back to Paul Ryan. He's going to have to sit down to this meal again.
Yeah. I mean, Mitch McConnell has said if it gets through the House, he's putting it on the floor in the Senate next week. We'll
and that,
see.
And whether or not it can pass.
Yeah. Or if he even does that.
And whether or not Republicans in the Senate will go for it. This is the state of Republicanism. This is the state of health care. Reid Galen, political consultant and Republican strategist. Thanks, Reid.
Thank you.
Also, Jeff Young, senior reporter for The Huffington Post. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Marvin, what do we do now?
Wait a minute. What?
There's a loose puck. It's loose in front. They score. Alex Carpenter has won it for the United States. Once again, Team USA has come to Canada and won the Women's World Hockey Championship.
You're listening there to the U.S. women's national hockey team becoming world champions last year. That sound is courtesy of TSN. The world championships this year are in Michigan, but the home team has threatened to boycott because players are protesting what they call unfair pay and unfair treatment by USA Hockey. The team has been negotiating with USA Hockey for more than 14 months now, and with those championships starting at the end of March in the U.S., no less, the stakes are extraordinarily high. Now USA Hockey appears to be making good on a threat to skip over the best women's hockey team in the world and go with replacement players. Lindsay Gibbs is a sports reporter for Think Progress. She's been following the story. Lindsay, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So this is the defending world championship team set up to defend their title on home ice in Michigan. I mean, the stakes couldn't be higher here, and the players are willing to stay away.
Absolutely. They've won 6 of the last 7 world championships. And like you said, it's at home. And about a week ago, they announced through social media that they would be boycotting these championships unless USA Hockey came back to the negotiating table with them and worked out a deal that they felt was fair, not only for their current players, but for the future of the sport.
Is this a question of salary? Are the women just looking for more money? What is this about?
It's partly salary. Currently, USA Hockey is only giving these women $6,000 in a four-year period. So they only give the U.S. Women's National Team $1,000 a month for the 6 months leading up to the Olympics. So that works out to not livable wages. I'm not great at math. So what they're looking for is a sustainable salary. I've read numbers around $60,000 to $70,000, not millions, but something that they can live and train and be full time. Because most of these women right now work 2-3 jobs in addition to training full time to be an elite athlete. Every 6 weeks, they have Team USA camps, tournaments. So they're ongoing relationships with USA Hockey throughout the four-year cycle, but are only getting paid for 6 months of that.
We've seen similar protests in other areas of sports. Of course, people have been following the U.S. women's soccer team and their dispute and negotiation with USA Soccer, mostly over salary there. Is this a similar set of disputes?
It is a similar, but I think it's important to note that hockey, and the women's hockey players know this, is about a couple decades behind where women's soccer is. They're looking about for a contract that the women of U.S. soccer secured in the year 2000, right after their 1999 World Cup victory. A contract that will not only, like I said, give them livable wages, but really invest in the future of the sport. Currently, USA Hockey spends about $3.5 million a year on elite boys training programs. There are no comparable elite girls programs. So they want to change that, and they want to make sure that girls who are coming up in the sport are given the resources to succeed as well.
So Lindsay Gibb, these negotiations are ongoing, and they're getting down to the wire. Kind of a shocking development. USA Hockey now says they're going to plumb the depths of what, American colleges to find replacement players and just go with them, or at least the threat to do so.
Yeah, this was pretty shocking. It seemed earlier this week the negotiations were going well. The two teams finally met for 10 hours on Monday. But just last night, USA Hockey announced, like you said, that they were going to start looking for replacement players. Now, that's going to be incredibly difficult for them to do because this is a really united front that the women have. Not only is the women's national team all on board, but they have gotten all the players who have ever been to a Team USA camp. So we're talking about your 18 and unders, your college players. All of those players, from what I know, are on board. Megan Duggan, who is a captain of the team, was on the phone with hundreds of players last week, making sure everyone was still with the united front. Because I think everyone realizes that this isn't just to get a livable wage for the current women on the national team. It's to make sure that things are set up for the future.
Yeah, here's a statement from the team saying, "The fact that the younger players identify with us, we are confident they would choose not to play."
Yeah, and I mean, you think, like, there is a National Women's Hockey League, so there is a small pro league for the women. There are other elite teams, and so you think if any of these women do cross this proverbial picket line, they're going to then have to go back and be teammates, right, with these national team women this fall, which could be pretty awkward. So there's a lot of reason for these women not to cross the picket line, to stay united front. And it's going to be really embarrassing for USA Hockey if they can't work out something and if they literally have no team.
Not just teammates, but they'll have to be opponents on the ice against
right.
the people who they crossed.
That is a good point. And as we know, hockey can get pretty physical. So I don't think you want that.
USA Hockey, I mean, it's maybe a standard threat to go with replacement players or replacement workers. They're basically guaranteeing, though, that the United States loses if they do that.
Oh, absolutely. I can't imagine that we would still have a competitive team. I mean, I think Team USA is pretty deep, but considering that there aren't a lot of players looking to cross this line, to take the ice, unless a contract is reached, it would be a pretty sorry sight.
Lindsay Gibb, sports reporter for Think Progress. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
The jury is out.
The jury has spoken, and they have sent an unmistakable message.
We, the jury
will reach a verdict.
It's not my problem. It's up to a jury to decide.
Now, you as jurors sit as judges of the evidence. You're called the trier of fact.
It's the process.
You're gonna be stuck in that motel for weeks.
If you're worried about how this country is going, jury duty is how you fix it.
No jury can declare a man guilty unless it's sure.
Next week, we're introducing you to a new series here on The Takeaway. It's called Of Our Peers, Improving the Jury System in America. We're working to find out if a jury can ever truly be impartial and what it's going to take to improve the current system. Plus, we're asking you about your experience with juries. From Eustis, Florida, I did not like the questionnaire that came with the selection process. Don't like being profiled in that way. But overall, it was a good experience and an honor to serve. And we got this from Wilmington, Delaware. I've been summoned, but the case was settled before trial. I strongly believe that we should abolish the well-intended but flawed system we have and use professional jurors.
Hi, this is Chris Liggett from Atlanta, Georgia. I served on a jury for a murder trial in Montana in the 1980s. The murder trial was fascinating. As far as improvements go, I think there needs to be a way to anonymize the jury selection. Maybe after each side takes their peremptory challenges, the remaining pool of, say, 20 to 30 candidates could be selected from at random to form the jury of 12.
We want you to join this conversation. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. And next week, we'll be exploring everything from the use of big data to learn more about jurors and their biases to how we define terms like reasonable doubt. It's of our peers, and it starts Monday.
The Takeaway is supported by Enterprise Florida, working to promote Florida as a premier business destination for companies interested in relocation or expansion. More information at floridathefutureishere.com. And Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turned cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at lumosity.com.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. The Sweet 16 of the NCAA Men's and Women's Division I Basketball Tournament is underway. And in between the timeouts, NCAA commercials like this one pitch a vision of college athletics as a pathway to opportunity.
It's not about where you were born or whether you're rich, poor, or in the middle. No matter what you play, if you have the skill and drive to succeed in school and in sports, will provide the opportunity.
It's a nice ad there, but a new study from the site The Undefeated finds that that promise is increasingly untrue. Less than 1 in 5 players in college sports are first-generation college students, and that number is dropping by the year. Tom Ferry is the executive director of the Sports and Society Program at the Aspen Institute and a reporter at ESPN. He led the study, and he says that changing expectations on campus and in youth sports are undermining what the NCAA claims to be its core values.
What we found through our research looking at NCAA surveys of college athletes is that most of them actually come from the middle class. Kids from first-generation homes, meaning neither parent had attended college, that they're actually pretty rare. I mean, less than 1 out of every 5 or so kids at the college level is from that type of family.
So is it the case that the phenomenon of the first-generation kid to go to college and his or her family who gets a scholarship, that phenomenon was never as common as we thought, or is it that it's just diminishing?
Well, we don't have great data on what happened in the 50s and 70s and 80s or even the early 2000s. What we do know is that the NCAA has conducted these surveys of 20,000 or so college athletes in 2010 and then 2014. And in 2010, they were surprisingly rare. And by 2014, or actually 2015, it had gone down in just about every single sport, the percentage has.
Is it that kids from disadvantaged homes or backgrounds are having less access to the pipeline? Are they getting edged out by kids from better economic circumstances, or is the denominator changing? Are there fewer first-generation kids who are trying to do this through sports?
Yeah, there are a couple things. Number one is the NCAA and its member institutions have introduced more rigorous academic standards. So to play college sports, to get into some of these universities, even with special admission type of criteria, it's gotten tougher over the past, 10 to 20 years. Colleges now can get punished. A program like the University of Connecticut, which won a men's D1 national basketball championship a few years ago, got banned from the NCAA tournament because they brought in too many of these kids. So coaches now will still take that chance on the occasional Allen Iverson type who comes out of that really disadvantaged environment, but they won't load up their entire recruiting class. The second thing that's happening, Todd, is that youth sports has changed in this country. Families are chasing the athletic scholarships starting when kids are around age 5, 6, 7 years old, as soon as they show some athletic aptitude. Once that happens, they start putting them on these travel teams, which cost money, and getting them the private trainers, which cost money, and going to out-of-state tournaments and everything else. Well, a lot of kids from disadvantaged homes simply cannot afford access to that pipeline. And that pipeline is where the college scouts live. They don't recruit at the high school level anymore. They don't, you know, follow one kid who's playing for one particular school. They want to go to these tournaments where all the best kids are. The economic barriers to entry for the kid who's from the truly disadvantaged home have risen.
It's shocking that we've driven competition, even for college scholarships, which were meant to be a way to an education for a kid with some talent, down to the 7-, 6-, 5-year-old level. It's astounding.
Yeah, it is. But it's the way America works, right? I mean, you tell parents, you know, only one out of every 100 kids at the high school level goes on to play D1 basketball or otherwise. And what they hear is, well, I better get started earlier. It makes them say, well, I guess I can't wait until my kid is 14, 15, 16 to introduce opportunities to them. I need to get them slotted early. I need to get them trained up. And off we go.
Is there any part of this that actually shows some economic progress? I mean, that there is a growing black middle class in this country, and those young African-American athletes would also have access to better education, better sports, better pipelines at a younger age than their counterparts from other economic situations. And if there were more of them, that might be sort of a good thing.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's exactly what we're seeing. Let's take a look at Georgetown, right? Georgetown in the 1980s and 90s was known for the kids who were from those disadvantaged homes. John Thompson recruited them, celebrated them, made a big deal about making sure they had a place on campus. So the Allen Iversons, the Patrick Ewings, the Michael Grahams, I mean, kids from really, really tough situations. Well, you look at the Georgetown roster now, and it's, you know, it's a couple of sons of NBA millionaires, you know, Alonzo Mourning's kid and George Mirasan's kid. Just about every other kid went to a private high school. So either they were born into advantage or they showed some potential really early and some private high school got them slotted. And so they accrued educational advantage, which allowed them to have the college sports opportunity.
If it's harder for them to get into the Georgetowns to play basketball, into the Michigans to play football, where are they going?
Well, I'd say a lot of them just simply get eliminated early. They don't have access to the pipeline. You know, the kid might have shown potential when he or she was, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, but they couldn't quite get on one of those teams, or maybe they're a late bloomer. If they do stay part of the system, some of it goes to junior colleges, or increasingly they're going to HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. You know, while the percentage of first gens has gone down in just about every sport, HBCUs over the past 5 years, it's actually grown. They're making more room for that kid. And frankly, the HBCUs are delivering on this idea that college sports is a tool of opportunity and educational attainment.
And, you know, Tom Ferry, it does make me wonder, look, is it time to have economic background a factor in athletic scholarships as well?
I mean, it's an interesting thought, right? I mean, because all athletic scholarships are essentially merit-based. If you can play the game, then we want you on our university. I mean, I think there's a good argument to be made that all athletic scholarships should be need-based. If college sports are truly going to be a tool of opportunity and educational advancement for kids who otherwise weren't headed to college, maybe we need to think about some structural changes in the nature of the athletic scholarship.
Tom Ferry, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Ferry is Executive Director of the Sports and Society Program at the Aspen Institute, and he's a reporter on ESPN.
If you love this podcast or any others, we need your help. All this month, we here at The Takeaway, along with lots of our partners and friends across the audio world, are trying to spread the word about podcasts. So here's what we need. We're asking you to tell a friend about a podcast they'll love. Right now, think of a friend, your mom, anyone you care about. What podcast would they really love? Got it now? Do it. Tell them about it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know about podcasts, show them how. It's easy. Tell them what you recommended with the hashtag tripod, TRYpod. Thanks for spreading the word.
You can have complete control.
Well, that was easy.
Yeah, I guess it was.
Gigabyte of RAM should do the trick. We're in. All right, what do we got?
Wow. Excellent.
We fixed the glitch.
I've lost the bleeps, I've lost the sweeps, and I've lost the creeps.
The what?
And the what? No, the bleeps, the sweeps,
And the creeps.
Hey, creeps. It's Friday when we talk movies here on The Takeaway. Rafer Guzman is with us, as always, film critic for Newsday. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
I want to start with trivia, as I always do when I'm here with you. We're going to be talking in just a minute, T2 Trainspotting. This is the new Trainspotting sequel with the original cast, starring Ewan McGregor, who got a real splash from that movie when it first came out. So keep Ewan McGregor on your mind. Here's trivia. Don't answer now, because we're going to hold the answer for the end. And if you know it, you can tweet me at Todd Zwillick if you think you know the answer. So here is Ewan McGregor. Listen to this clip from Big Fish, a great movie from 2003. You're going to hear young Ewan McGregor here as himself and old Ewan McGregor. Listen.
You don't know me, but my name is Edward Bloom, and I love you.
There's a time when a man needs to fight, and a time when he needs to accept that his destiny's lost. The ship has sailed, and that only a fool will continue.
You heard young Ewan McGregor sounding a lot like Jeff Sessions, actually. Who is playing old Ewan McGregor at the end of that clip from Big Fish? Who is that? Don't answer now. Tweet me at Todd Zwillick if you know it. Rafer, speaking of Ewan McGregor, let's go to T2 Trainspotting. This is the sequel reboot. Here's a clip.
Can't fail again, Mark. You know, I need to detox the system.
Oh, Spud, detox the system. What does that even mean? It doesn't mean anything. It's not getting it out of your body that's the problem. It's getting it out of your mind. You are an addict.
I think I haven't heard that 100,000 times, Mark. You got 12 more steps for my comedy.
So, be addicted. Be addicted to something else.
Like you're running until I feel sick?
Yes. Or something else.
Trainspotting, the seminal movie for Gen Xers of the 90s. How's this reboot?
I have a lot of feelings about this movie, Todd.
Of a certain age.
Well, I've aged along with this movie, and it's pretty amazing to see all these guys back together. You know, 20-something years later, that's Ewan Bremner there as Spud, the hapless addict from the first movie. Yeah. Robert Carlyle's back as Begbie, Johnny Lee Miller as Sick Boy. It's great to see these guys together, and I think the film is a little bit caught, as is Ewan McGregor in this movie, between facing of the fact that you sort of can't go home again, you can't relive past glories, and yet the film keeps kind of trying to here and there. If you remember the original Trainspotting, you'll recognize some of the scenes that kind of get sort of replayed here in this movie. So there's a little bit of a push and pull there in this movie. And I liked that, but at the same time, it just doesn't have the energy. It doesn't have the kind of wildness of the first. I mean, how can it really, right? But like I say, I'm very on the fence, because it was great to see all these people that I kind of remember from my youth.
So many sequels suffer from this kind of ambiguity.
It's true. But yeah. I mean, I do think this one deserves credit for kind of trying to face up to mortality. And I thought that was interesting.
All right. Let's face up to some sci-fi with Life from Daniel Espinosa. This one is starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Rebecca Ferguson.
Nothing in that lab can malfunction.
It's on me.
Yeah, it's on you. You know, I know at least 5 guys back home who can do my job. Nobody can do yours except you. We don't know what it is. And you're in there and you're playing around with it like it's your buddy. I'm your buddy.
This will never be a controlled experiment. So let's all agree we made our first and last mistake.
Some high thriller sci-fi there.
Yeah, I would say I can describe this movie in pretty much one word. Alien. This is exactly the same thing.
The trailer
as
looked
Alien.
Like that.
I mean, you can tell, right? You know, there are some decent special effects. There's a couple of good sort of gruesome, gory moments that are fun. But I mean, you have seen this before back in 1979 with the original Alien movie, and there's not really much more to offer here.
And also, Alien Covenant is coming out. So if you need an Alien fix,
right,
you're going to be getting it soon. You don't need a lesser facsimile, maybe.
That's exactly
right. All right, let's go back to trivia. Let's replay that clip. I played you young Ewan McGregor from Big Fish, and old Ewan McGregor. Here's the clip.
You don't know me, but my name is Edward Bloom, and I love you.
There's a time when a man needs to fight, and a time when he needs to accept that his destiny's lost. The ship has sailed, and that only a fool will continue.
Who is old Ewan McGregor, Rafer?
Todd, you've stumped me. No idea.
Oh, dear. Cody Shelley on Twitter says, that's barely trivia. It's Albert Finney.
Ah.
Thank you. Cody Shelley on Twitter got it first. You nailed it. Rafer Guzman did not. Rafer Guzman of Newsday, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Todd.
Hi, this is Andy calling from Seattle, Washington. I see a lot fewer bats and a lot fewer honeybees.
Hey, bumblebee, come on and sting.
So they used to be all over my neighborhood.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And as you can hear there, we've been asking you all week about what changes you've noticed in your environment, whether it's due to climate change or some other factor. And if you think about it, it's probably been a long time since you've seen more than one bumblebee at a time. The fat, fuzzy, rusty-patched bumblebee was one of the most common bumblebees in America, but its population has dropped more than 90% in two decades. Then this week, the Department of the Interior placed the rusty-patched bumblebee, otherwise known as Bombus affinis, on the endangered species list. It's a move with implications far beyond the fortunes of one type of little bee. And Sam Droege is head of the Bee Inventory and Monitoring Lab at the U.S. Geological Survey. He joins me now. Sam Droege, welcome.
Thank you.
90% is a huge number. What does that mean for the number of bees that we see around and their ability to do their job as bumblebees?
Well, it's actually probably much more than 90%, which we have so little information that we can't quite estimate what the actual number is, but that's a conservative estimate. In terms of all the bees, well, there's a lot of capacity. We have 4,000 different species. This is one of them. It was the most common, or one of the most common, of the bumblebees. So east of Indiana, they're essentially completely absent now. So other bumblebees have to make up for that deficit.
Why? What's killing them off?
Well, there's pathogens that, if we have all of our science right, came in from Europe as during some transfers of bumblebees between the two continents. And while the European bumblebees are adapted to this pathogen, that pathogen, when introduced to the novel bumblebees, let's call it, from North America, it hit some extremely hard. Others seem to be able to tolerate it. Bombus affinis is one of those that really just completely tanked, and now we've lost almost all the population.
Are there other factors as well besides this infectious pathogen that's affected the bees so deeply?
Yeah, so overall, the environment has, if you want to think about it, bees live off of pollen. So when you have fewer flowers, you automatically have fewer bees. So as we more industrialize our agriculture and as we spread in where we live and where we use, in general, the habitat begins to diminish in terms of the number of flowers it's going to produce. It's sort of a natural byproduct of putting down pavement, let's say. Overall, the environment is a bit of a harsher place, but there's many, many spots and locations where there's totally sufficient flowers, including people's backyards. And this bee was a bee of the backyards as well as farmlands. It was a pollinator of crops, and it was in our refuges and other places. So it's not per se a lack of habitat. It's not per se a pesticide issue. Those are factors that affect all bees, but the pathogen really just put it over the edge.
So we all know what a crucial role bees play as pollinators in the environment, not only for natural flora, but for crops as well. What is the environment potentially losing here if this very common type of bumblebee goes extinct?
So it's really a highly integrated system. So removing one member isn't going to cause the house to collapse. But if you start removing a lot of them, then all of a sudden you become more and more vulnerable to what ultimately could be a pollinator crisis. We're not there at this point, but it's something that we're concerned about. We don't want to lose these members.
Well, let's do a little bit of bumblebee appreciation. Okay. You take some amazing close-up photos of these bees.
We do, yeah. It's a group project within our lab.
What sets the rusty-patched bumblebee apart from other bees, or especially other bumblebees? What are the fuzzy features that make it different?
When you look at a rusty-patched bumblebee, if you ever had the opportunity to do that, you would notice, if you were a bumblebee aficionado, that they have a much shorter head, and the hairs on their head are completely black. And while that doesn't sound that particularly appealing, perhaps they are an extremely cute bumblebee, if I become non-scientific for a moment. And then the rusty patch has to do with a rust to red colored patch on their abdomen, the back end of the bumblebee, that's absent from other species. So it is identifiable if you have a good pair of close focusing binoculars, or like us, we look at them in the laboratory. Visually, the aesthetic is something that it just resonates with me when I get to look at them under the microscope.
For those of us on the radio, I mean, look, the best feature of the bumblebee is just that sound. Of course, it comes from the beating of the wings, but do you have any information on just how fast or how hard those wings go to make that fantastic sound?
I don't. And I have to say that while we do hear certain bees in the field, they have a sound that's, you know, attracts us. Bumblebees are actually not one of them. So we talk about the buzz of bumblebees, but they're more or less silent when they're flying. So it's just one of many. Honeybees are the ones that you can hear. Like, I can go out in the field, I can hear the honeybees in an area. I don't hear the bumblebees.
I've been duped all along. Well, let's talk about the Endangered Species Act a little bit. It's it's a sad development, and it's a harbinger of bad things. Does this help the Rusty Patch at all?
It does. It helps it in probably the most important way, which is it focuses people's attention on it, like yourself and others who might not otherwise know that we've lost or nearly lost an entire bumblebee species, something that, unlike a lot of rarity that becomes an endangered species, this was extremely common. This was the kind of thing that everyone had the opportunity to see and lived in their backyards. So without the Endangered Species Act, we would not hear about that. And also it galvanizes resources. So right now we know that Fish and Wildlife Service, who has primary responsibility for the bee in terms of its recovery, is focusing survey efforts to see if they can find any more of these populations. And they're also focusing research on some of the causal factors. But it also has meant that state agencies and private groups like the Xerxes Society and others are putting together programs to try and find the bee. It's a tricky one to study in terms of how do we recover it. It's more about creating a capacity in the landscape, i.e. more and more diverse flowers. And then the bee is going to have to, in a way, heal itself. It has to have enough relief from all the other kinds of problems so that whatever is going on that allows those populations that remain to remain alive and healthy to continue to propagate and hopefully recover so that throughout their range here in Maryland, for example, we'll see the bee again.
Well, Sam Droege, thanks for stopping by to talk to us about it. I really appreciate it. Sam Droege is head of the Bee Inventory and Monitoring Lab at the U.S. Geological Survey.
Well, thank you very much.
The vernal equinox has passed. It is officially springtime, and that means not only is baseball season coming, but so is spring break, and you may find yourself in the park or on the beach with some earbuds in your ears. Melissa Locker is culture reporter for Time and The Guardian and The Takeaway, and Melissa is here because she has some of your spring break podcast listening needs fulfilled. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Todd.
It's great to have you here. I've been hearing a lot. Let's get right to it. Missing Richard Simmons is a new podcast miniseries. Richard Simmons, the famous workout guru, is gone, right?
Richard Simmons has pretty much vanished off the face of the earth.
In real life.
And what this podcast is it's a guy who used to work out at Slimmins, who was, Slimmins is like the workout facility that he had in Los Angeles. And he goes and he's trying to figure out what happened to his friend and mentor. And he goes and interviews a whole bunch of people, and he tries to really track down Richard Simmons. And a lot of people are asking about why he's following this guy, and he kind of explains it in the show.
The lines were so blurred between being Richard the famous guy, Richard the weight loss mentor, Richard the friend, and anonymous Richard S., just the regular guy in a chat room who needs help sometimes. Those blurred lines were the genius of Richard Simmons, but also the peril.
There's no reason to believe that there's a crime involved here. Is there something prurient about doing this podcast for public consumption when we don't really know what's happened to Richard Simmons?
He addresses that a lot, and a lot of people have commented on that, saying like, hey, if he wants to disappear and there's no, idea that something untoward has happened to him, just let him go. But he kind of explores like relationships that Richard Simmons built with people all over the world during his time in the spotlight and why it's so hard for people to let him go.
All right. There's a new podcast called Sincerely X that you have on the list here. Audible and Amazon Prime are running this. And the title Sincerely X implies anonymity. I guess people get to tell the types of stories that they really can't tell in public, right?
Yeah, so these actually come through TED and TED Talks, and these are the TED Talks that people want to do anonymously. So the stories tend to be a little dark, a little deep, but they're absolutely fascinating. Like there will be a story about a woman who was in an abusive relationship who found a way to get out of it.
Recently, a doctor at the Mayo Clinic said after a routine physical that his only recommendation would be for me to tell others about it. He told me that what I did was actually quite profound, and that it had a lot in common with mindfulness and meditation used to heal trauma.
So you can see how, with the grant of anonymity here, you can get people to tell the types of stories that they wouldn't tell in public or if they had to expose a friend or a loved one or even themselves.
And this particular one with the woman in this abusive marriage, like the way that she recovered from that is absolutely fascinating with some real-life medical applications, which you would never really expect.
All right, if we wanted to lighten it up a little bit, it is spring break. What's going on over at Song Exploder?
So Song Exploder is one of my favorite podcasts. Bands and artists come in and they break down their songs, like U2 and Iggy Pop and Carly Rae Jepsen and Solange and Metallica. And you may recognize this woman.
Moments of clarity are so rare. I better document this.
Probably the most obvious lyrics I've ever written.
Obvious. There's only one Bjork.
There's only one Bjork.
And finally, I think we do have to mention the folks at This American Life and Serial, the godmothers and fathers of the podcast world, are back. They've got S-Town, a new investigation with executive producer Sarah Koenig.
This is part of their Serial Productions. It's their new production company, and this is the very first one. It's called S-Town. I've listened to the first four episodes, and it is so good. The story is absolutely compelling. It twists, it turns, and you have no idea where it's going to end up. And if you happen to be traveling with kids, there are a couple of good podcasts for children. One is The Disappearance of Mars Patel, which is excellent, and it's a serialized story. And the other is Short and Curly, which is sort of a ethics podcast for children.
Several suggestions for your downloading pleasure and for your earbuds, whether they are wireless or with wires. For spring break, Melissa Locker, culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway. Thanks as always.
Thanks.
And it is the news of the day. House Republican leaders are trying to strong-arm their plan to repeal and replace Obamacare through Congress. The House vote was scheduled for yesterday, but then it got pushed to today when it became clear that leadership didn't have the votes to pass it. GOP strategist Reid Galen says the Republicans have been caught on their heels here.
Everyone assumed, me included, that Hillary Clinton was going to be president and it was going to be status quo, you know, on Obamacare and many other things. So, you know, they had 7 years of repeal votes, 50-some votes in the House or whatever it was. Suddenly they find themselves with both the White House and the Congress and no plan to speak of.
A couple more things to watch for besides just the vote count, which is critical. One, remember this bill goes to the Senate where it's going to be changed or possibly killed. This debate is not over. Also, President Trump says that if this bill fails, he's moving on. Obamacare stays in place. What does that mean for Republicans who've promised to repeal it? And you should know that late last night, operatives within the White House were already floating attack lines that they might use on Speaker Paul Ryan if this effort fails. That's right, on Paul Ryan, the speaker of their own party. I'll be watching this bill all day long. I'll be watching the White House, too. And you can follow along with me if you want. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Todd Zwillick. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I am Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. And Squarespace, a website building platform that helps businesses, entrepreneurs, and individuals to create websites, portfolios, online stores, and more. Learn more at squarespace.com. Squarespace, make your next move.
PRI, Public Radio International.